Welcome to Tech Policy Podcast. My name is Ashkan Kazarian, and today is our first episode with all female participants. So we have Sarah St. Vincent from Human Rights Watch. She's a researcher on U.S. national security, surveillance, and domestic law enforcement. Thank you, Sarah, for being here.
No, oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk to you.
We're really excited to talk about parallel construction today. Sarah, is parallel construction some sort of weird way government build roads, or what is it about?
So parallel construction is basically the government creating an alternative explanation for how it found a piece of evidence in order to conceal what it actually did. So we've been researching parallel construction at Human Rights Watch for about 18 months. I've written a report on it that should be coming out early next year, in which we document the practice and sort of explain how it works and what some of the potential human rights problems are with it. But you can think of it as the government creating a story for how it discovered something other than what actually happened.
So you're saying that government somehow gets access to evidence, mm-hmm. and then they lie about the way they got that evidence?
We do have multiple defense attorneys on the record in this report characterizing this as a fiction or lying. I think that as I was describing to someone recently, it's certainly omitting the truth. And so whether you think there's daylight between omitting the truth and lying, I think is a question for you.
I mean, law is full of gray colors. So how common is this practice? Because it sounds terrifying.
Our research suggests that it happens daily, that it's actually a very frequent occurrence. Now, the question I think we need to ask is, what is it being used to conceal? And so my research was partly centered around trying to find out how often it's used to conceal intelligence surveillance, some of the problematic types of programs that we found out about, for example, through the Snowden disclosures. But parallel construction can be used to conceal a lot of different law enforcement techniques. It can be used to conceal the fact that there's a confidential informant in a case. It can be used to conceal a wiretap that, say, the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, is not yet ready to reveal for whatever reason. It could be used to conceal intelligence surveillance. It can potentially be used to conceal a lot of different things.
So what are the methods that government uses? Let's break this down. So what ways you have researched and discovered that government has done this?
There are a variety of different ways, and I want to flag a groundbreaking article that was written about this in August 2013 by Reuters, John Schiffman and Christina Cook. If you Google parallel construction Reuters, you'll find it, where they, I don't know that they, I think the practice was certainly known among law enforcement and among prosecutors for probably decades before this, but they really brought it to public attention. And so they highlight a classic kind of parallel construction, what I've come to think of as a classic kind of parallel construction, which is a traffic stop. So if you're the DEA and you've gotten a tip, it could be from a the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Because not all of us have, you know, had a run-in with them. I'm just
So if I'm the Drug Enforcement Administration, and I've gotten a tip, could be from an NSA database, could be from a confidential human informant, could be from any number of sources. But I don't want to reveal that program, at least not yet. What I might do is call a state trooper or a local police officer and say, here is a car that I would like you to find a reason to pull over. Like, so here's the description of the car. Develop your own probable cause to pull this vehicle over and search it. Often, it seems, they don't even tell the local police what they're looking for. And so local police will then go out, find this car, start following it, notice that it has a broken taillight, or that it's speeding, or that it's crossed over into another lane briefly.
Or a random check. I keep getting every time I get into an airport, I kept getting randomly selected. They haven't found anything, and I don't think they will ever will. But getting randomly selected is also a thing, right?
Well, so at least in theory for a traffic stop, they have to have a reason to pull you over. Now, I can talk in a second about how there's no accountability if it turns out that they didn't. But in theory, they'll find some reason, some traffic violation to pull you over. And then they'll say, hey, can we have consent to search your car? And if you decline consent, they'll find some reason to keep you there to bring a dog to sniff if drugs are what they're looking for. Or they'll keep kind of questioning you, even though in theory you should have been free to go, basically until they're able to do the search they want to do to find the contraband that they're looking for. But if you're the defendant, as far as you know, your case started with that traffic stop. You'll never find out about, let me put it this way, you're unlikely to find out what the real source of this was. Sometimes the government does voluntarily disclose, like, oh yes, we got a tip, and that's why we asked the state trooper to do the stop. But I'm sure that in some cases they don't. And so if your case really started with a confident, a very sensitive source, you're unlikely to find out. And as far as you know, your case started with speeding.
So parallel construction in general is this practice that government uses to omit the first part of law enforcement process.
Mm-hmm.
How do they justify it? Has anyone from government spoken about this, just trying to justify this practice?
The government has not spoken about it publicly, at least not extensively. I think that in the research that we've done using court documents and in the interviews I've done, we've been able to piece together what I think their legal justifications probably are. And the key thing I want listeners to know is that it's not necessarily that the government is doing something illegal or thinks it's doing something illegal under U.S. law, although certainly I would say there are serious constitutional problems here. The problem is what the law allows or can be read to allow, and the problem is that you could have a government developing these legal interpretations in the dark, where you don't, you know, the defendant and the court don't really get to test those and potentially poke holes in them. So, for example, the government could say, well, we had an independent source. The independent source was the search of the car, you know, and so we don't, it's not fruit of the poisonous tree, because normally if you...
So what is fruit of a poisonous tree?
Right. So normally, if I'm the defendant and I think that evidence was gathered unconstitutionally, I can say that everything else that flowed from that evidence, everything else the police found as a result, should be excluded because of that original constitutional violation. I say it was fruit of the poisonous tree. So if I break down your door illegally and then I find cocaine, I can say, well, that was an illegal search, and when you found the cocaine, that's fruit of the poisonous tree because you did something unconstitutional to get it.
So the way government gets to your evidence is crucial for them to be able to use it.
Yeah, absolutely. So suppression is usually not something that's required. Wiretapping is a little bit of a different case. But in general, it's usually not the case that courts have to suppress evidence, but suppression is a really key means of upholding defendants' rights. Otherwise, law enforcement could just go around violating constitutional rights willy-nilly. When they know that this could be excluded from the trial, it gives them an incentive, as the Supreme Court has noted, it gives them an incentive to follow the law.
So going back a little bit, since this practice sounds horrifying, what agencies have you discovered in your research have done this? Who has used this practice?
We have found cases in which the government has ultimately disclosed that it did a pretextual traffic stop. And I want to say again, a traffic stop is not the only way of doing parallel construction, and I can get to some of the others in a second. But in cases we found where the government has admitted that it did this, the agencies requesting parallel construction, basically requesting the traffic stop, have been the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, DHS, which includes ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, specifically Homeland Security Investigations, and also the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives.
So all the key ones.
Many of the key federal law enforcement organizations in the country, yeah.
What about local law enforcement? Are they usually the participants in the way that this big federal agencies call them and ask them to make a stop, go search this house? Or do they sometimes have the same practice, or they just don't have the resources for it?
The truth is, I don't know. And this is something that I think would be great for somebody else to be looking into. I think because I have been really focusing on the ways that this might be used to disguise intelligence surveillance, which is very constitutionally problematic. I have not really looked into whether, for example, the state police could ask local law enforcement or local law enforcement could ask each other to do this. So I don't know. But certainly many of the legal justifications that I think the federal government is using is also something the state could try to rely on.
So, well, if there's anyone out there who has the time and the knowledge and the ability, we encourage you to read everything Sarah has written and go on and legally research this question. So I feel like ever since you started talking about this, at least for me, but maybe I'm a lawyer, it's been red flag, constitutional law, civil liberties. But let's talk about this a little bit more. How exactly does this practice violate Americans' civil liberties?
Sure. So I think there are two distinct things that we need to think about. One is in what ways does this practice itself violate constitutional rights, and in what ways can it be used to cloak other constitutional violations? So if you have an NSA program that arguably violates the Fourth Amendment, criminal cases are one of the few ways that that could actually come to the public's attention. Of course, they're classified programs. All the information about it is classified. It would be criminal for somebody to give it to you, but it could come out through a criminal trial. But parallel construction prevents that from happening. And so it could very well be that you have surveillance that violates the Fourth Amendment or other constitutional rights, but that because of parallel construction, that never comes to light. And so it could be that there's a privacy violation or free expression violation or whatever constitutional violation itself involved in the case from that surveillance. Now, the concealment practice itself, parallel construction, can be said to violate due process rights. Again, it could violate actually the Fifth Amendment. You have a right to exculpatory evidence under the Constitution.
So an exculpatory evidence.
Exculpatory evidence is anything that might be favorable to the defense.
So basically, the fact that government via surveillance tools gathered some information and then based their prosecution, their inquiry on that information might have something that will exonerate you, but you will never get access to it. Even if it doesn't
exonerate you, it might be something favorable to you or material to your defense.
The fact that they gathered it under the dark in this unknown land behind closed doors.
Sure. Or there might be any number of ways that you as the defense might want to challenge the credibility or the completeness or the accuracy of that information. Or you might say, well, do you have other data that might tend to exculpate to basically show that the defendant either didn't do what they're charged with doing or that the circumstances are not what the prosecution says they were.
So if I'm a defense lawyer, which my mom really wanted me to be, and not work in policy, why can't I just ask the prosecution to tell me and say, hey man, we work every day together, you know me, I know you, we know the judge, it's a small courthouse, we all know each other, just tell me, how did you get this, why did my defendant get stopped?
You can, and defense attorneys have tried it, and if you do, you will fail. And the reason for that is that, at least in federal cases, so to be clear, I've also seen state cases involving parallel construction, but prosecutors will have a variety of arguments to prevent defendants from ever finding out if parallel construction was done in their cases, and in particular, if intelligence surveillance was involved in their cases. And I have seen cases where I think the defense had a colorable argument that intelligence surveillance might have been involved. And when defense attorneys try to find out, the prosecution will first say, well, you're just speculating, and you have no evidence that you were surveilled, to which the answer is, well, of course I don't. You know, that's probably all classified.
But my phone was breaking up. It was weird. I was wondering, so since you focus on the intelligence part of it, do you want to talk a little bit? You mentioned the Snowden revelations and the programs that we found out existed because of Snowden, and that those programs are used for parallel construction, like they're ground zero, where it starts. So what kind of programs are you referring to?
Well, let me come back to that in a second. I want to go back for a moment to this question of what happens when the defense tries to ask the prosecution what happened in the case, or if this happened in the case. So first, as I said, the prosecution will say, well, you're just speculating and you don't have any evidence that you were surveilled. Or they will say, we have no reason to believe that intelligence information was involved in the case. They don't say yes or no. They'll say, basically, we have no reason to think that. And if the defense tries to say, well, you should go check with the intelligence community, the prosecution will say, we don't have to, and the judge shouldn't be obligated to make us. And especially if you try to say, so under Brady, which is the Supreme Court decision that establishes your right to exculpatory evidence, you are entitled to any exculpatory evidence that is in the government's possession. And so the prosecution will come back and say, well, the NSA is not part of the prosecution team. So even if the NSA has it,
and
we don't.
The files are not in our possession.
The files are not in our possession. And again, we have no reason to think that, and we shouldn't be obligated to go ask.
I see. So now let's talk about the intelligence and the Snowden programs that can be ground zero for parallel construction to exist. What kind of programs have you seen or suspected are used?
There are a couple of ways of looking at this. So there's an intelligence surveillance law called Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, first adopted in 2007 and then really adopted in 2008 and renewed in 2012. And Section 702 lets the intelligence community target what are called non-U.S. persons, so basically non-U.S. citizens, non-green card holders who are outside of the United States, for warrantless surveillance for a potentially pretty broad range of purposes. But in doing that, they can sweep up Americans' communications, quote-unquote, incidentally. You can think of it as sort of accidentally on purpose. Because so, for example, if you are in Germany and I'm emailing you and you're not a U.S. person, if you're the target of 702 surveillance, the government is going to get my communication to you. So I am still, as a U.S. person, still potentially going to be surveilled. The government has disclosed, so the government runs at least two very large surveillance programs under Section 702. One of them is called PRISM, which involves the government going to the tech companies and with orders demanding large volumes of data on the targets, including private communications.
So they go to Google and say, give me the emails.
Facebook, Apple, Microsoft. Sure, emails, chats.
iCloud photos.
Sure, Skype calls, things of that nature, potentially in very large volumes. Another is another 702 program is called quote-unquote upstream scanning, which basically, from what we can tell, involves the government sitting on the internet, if you will, and scanning all the traffic that passes through the underseas cables that connect the U.S. to the rest of the world.
So we just suspect that somewhere along the cable, they just tap into it.
Yeah, they have not released much detail or any detail really about how it works. And so, for example, the ACLU has tried to explain how it works and the government will say, no, that's wrong. But they don't really provide much detail about what
they think
the right answer is.
So we're just trying to guess. Well, listeners, for now, just imagine that under the sea somewhere, there is someone diving in, connecting to a cable and getting all of your emails into a database.
Well, and if even if they're not retaining them, but that they would be scanning them for information on the targets. So despite the huge size of these programs and the fact that incidental collection on U.S. persons under them is probably very large, there have been notifications in about 8 criminal cases in the United States.
And notification means that the defendant was notified that that the evidence was collected via these programs?
Yeah. So for a long time, actually until about 2012, there were no notifications at all. After a controversial set of events involving a Supreme Court case that I can get into if you like, the prosecution started providing notice in a couple of cases. As I said, I found 8. I know there are probably a couple more out there where the prosecution has said, yes, 702 surveillance data was involved in your case. They have often done that belatedly, sometimes after trial, sometimes after sentencing. So not always in a very timely sort of way.
Would that be, just thinking about those defendants, would that be a reason for an appeal? In your legal opinion?
Defendants have tried, certainly. And in fact, there's a case that is currently... So it came out of Oregon. A young man took part in... And he took part along with an FBI informant in a supposed plot to bomb Pioneer Square, I think in a Christmas Eve ceremony. And he was arrested as part of that sting operation, and it was disclosed very late. I think it was before sentencing, but after conviction, that 702 surveillance data had been involved in his case. And his attorneys did argue that he should have gotten a new trial, you know, with the suppression of the evidence, et cetera. That case, they've now petitioned the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, to hear the case.
Obviously, these cases are never... It's never an easy case. It's never a case of a grandma passing on a green on a red light. It's always a terrible, terrible crime that happened or was going to happen, some really bad motive. But the constitutional rights and the Fourth Amendment rights still apply. And that's the way it works. They should apply to everyone, even the worst people with the worst intentions, correct?
Absolutely. But also when you say, oh, you know, these are only the worst cases, I want to say, are you sure? Because if the government is not providing notice, if they are using parallel construction, we will never know if they're using intelligence surveillance, including sweeping programs like those under 702, or an even bigger authority known as Executive Order 12333, where the government actually has said they don't think they're obligated to provide notice at all under any circumstances to defendants in criminal cases. So it could very well be that the government winds up employing this data in some way as part of drug investigations, tax fraud, intellectual property type cases, who knows?
And government actually representatives of law enforcement in Senate and House hearings have said before on record that they don't oppose the idea of using this in a drug investigation or in a tax investigation. And we don't know if they actually do that already, because as you said, this all happens under classified construction of of enforcement procedures. And yeah, there's just no way of knowing unless little pieces of evidence or little pieces of information just come through and you just try to piece them together. Right.
Sure. And I think actually some members of Congress could and do have a problem with this if it's being done. I know Senator Leahy in a hearing asked the acting general counsel of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence if 702 data could be used for a tax fraud case or a drug case. And their response was basically a recitation of the law. It was not a response. It was not a yes or no. And so we still don't know what they're doing, what they think they can do. But I think that part of what parallel construction does is prevent us from knowing that. It prevents us from knowing if this data is being used in this way, and it prevents the public from evaluating whether the intelligence community should be running these programs.
So since we're doing Surveillance 101 for our listeners, there is such thing as Privacy Shield, which is this agreement with EU that helps our tech business be global. Will the fact that parallel construction exists, this knowledge altogether, anyway affect our negotiations with you? Because the Privacy Shield is up for review right now. So, and if it comes down, if the agreement stops working, basically American tech business in Europe will be under attack. It won't be able to operate there.
Yeah, so the issue you're referring to is, so yes, as you said, there's an EU-US arrangement that makes it legal for companies such as Amazon, such as Apple, whatever the case might be, to transfer their users' data from the EU, which has very strong privacy protections in law, to what's called a third country, a non-EU country, in this case the US. And the basis for that is the idea that the US provides adequate protections for privacy and other fundamental rights that are relevant in this area. And so under the Privacy Shield arrangement, the European Commission annually has to review that finding. They actually just concluded their review yesterday. I saw that the report came out, and they have approved it. They have found that U.S. privacy protections are adequate. We certainly disagree with that assessment, and we actually have told them about parallel construction in a letter that we sent about a week or two into October. And certainly, I mean, as I said, the review is annual, and so I hope to publish my report in January, and certainly I will be hoping to take this up with them, because one of the key issues in this area that the Court of Justice of the EU has highlighted is the importance of a remedy, that if your rights are violated, you have a human right to a remedy, not only because you ought to be made whole for that violation, but also because, again, it deters the state from just repeating this behavior. And so in the United States, if defendants don't get notification, then again, their rights are just being violated with impunity. And under EU human rights standards, that's not okay. And so we do hope that the European Commission in the future will take the parallel construction issue on board.
Well, thank you for catching us up. I thought it was still under review. Didn't, I guess, see the news, or, you know, these days there's so much white noise. You don't know what to focus on. Well, we'll see if next year they will take into account this issue. So to close this up, I want to ask you, because this, you know, we've talked about this issue and it seems very, very crucial for our civil rights, for our just legal system altogether. Is there any potential solution? Is there any way we can address it? What would be the steps? What would be the suggestions you'd make?
Yeah. In order to talk about that, let me talk about what happens now. What happens now is that if you happen to have a defense attorney, if I, as the defendant, happen to have an attorney who is clued in enough that they know about this issue and they're willing to push, and they're willing to make the motions and make the arguments and in hearings and really push and try to get the prosecution to go back and check with the intelligence community to see what was done. If they push hard enough, I just might find myself with a more favorable plea bargain offer. I might find myself with the charges dismissed. If I have a less savvy attorney who doesn't think to raise this issue,
or a public defense lawyer who has 200 cases pending.
Right. Although I got to say that federal public defenders have really been out front on this issue and I think have been doing some totally amazing work. But certainly, like, if you have an attorney who, yeah, doesn't have the capacity maybe to bring it up or for whatever reason, I don't necessarily wind up with that more favorable result for myself. And so the government's very secrecy and willingness to protect this creates an unequal system. And so what would rectify all of this would be stronger notice provisions in the law. So the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act has a notice requirement that I think the government is probably secretly interpreting in a way that lets it basically avoid giving notice in 702 cases and other FISA cases, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. if Congress were to adopt stronger notice provisions, and if courts were to hold the intelligence community's feet to the fire as well and say to prosecutors, you need to go check with the NSA and see what, if anything, they did in this case. You need to check with, you know, whatever the case might be in terms of the intelligence agency involved. If there were notice for this, if defendants could get to challenge it, then we would have a more equitable system. We would have greater confidence that evidence stemming from a constitutional violation is not being used to put people in jail. And again, we're talking about something very serious, taking away people's liberty. I mean, that's one of the most serious things that happens in this country. You know, and you'd also, I think, have greater transparency for the public. What's being done in their names? Is this democratic? You know, the scale of the surveillance, the impact of it, the uses of it, such that the public can do what in a democracy you're supposed to do, tell members of Congress what kind of surveillance programs you want. And again, so that this key check on the intelligence agencies, the courts, can decide what's being done and whether it's constitutional.
Sarah, so you mentioned that these are not only traffic stop cases that you have discovered. What else has happened that led to prosecution under parallel construction?
So the confirmed cases that we've seen have all been traffic stops because we managed to come across a couple of key terms that get used in this context to refer to those stops. And once you know those terms, you can search legal databases and find ways of finding those cases where the government has chosen to disclose this. However, Reuters also turned up some training materials from the Internal Revenue Service that list things like pen register trap and trace orders as a means of carrying out parallel construction. Also subpoenas, I'm sure, for things like subscriber information, for example, from an internet company. I'm trying to think there were a couple of other...
So what is a pen registry?
So a pen register is something that gets your telephone call records. And under Supreme Court case law, the government doesn't need a warrant to get those.
So if you see the words pen registry, you know that's something you should look into more.
A pen register, like I said, it means call records. And so, yes. Yeah, it could be that the government goes and does that. It could also be potentially that the government, in a case that does involve intelligence surveillance, does a surveillance under Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Like I said, this basis for these big secret programs, or like programs, the details of which are still secret. And then it goes and gets what's called a regular FISA warrant, which is a lot less controversial. And the applications for those are usually sealed and remain classified.
So they get information through a classified program and then go get another approval from a court to proceed that is less classified and more structured and known to general public.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of putting it. And again, potentially, we do know that this probably happened in some of the cases where 702 notification was later provided. How much it happens beyond that, we don't know, because often the defense will just know, the government may give notification that regular FISA, the regular Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrant, was something that the government got, but doesn't necessarily know what happened before that.
Well, this is very alarming, but because of people like Sarah and Human Rights Watch and other organizations, including Tech Freedom, who work on surveillance programs and work on this, legal issues, you should all just look it up. We will link to Sarah's report when it comes out. We will link to the Reuters article that Sarah mentioned. And we're hoping if you have more questions, you can contact Tech Freedom or Human Rights Watch. Call your representatives and just be aware that this is a practice that exists. It has a lot of red flags and questionable parts of it. And just, stay woke. Well, thank you for being here. And this was Sarah St. Vincent from Human Rights Watch joining us to talk about parallel construction and surveillance programs. Sarah, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.